You're listening to Aperitivo, first broadcast on the 9th of October 2013 on Monocle 24. Aperitivo, brought to you by The Glenlivet. Hello from Midori House in London and welcome to Aperitivo, coming to you live from Studio One and also from just down the road at the Monocle Cafe. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show...
A lot of colleagues sort of flagged up the fact that he seems to be stepping into a political debate. You know, in this country, the securocrats, especially people like him, are very much kept out of that.
The chief of Britain's security services slams NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden and the media who have disseminated his leaks. Jeffrey Kaufman and Matthew Jamieson are here to tell us more. With the Financial Times announcing changes to its print edition, we look at the evolution and future of the newspaper and what it tells us about the future of other newspapers. And we'll meet the author Tom Holland for coffee, conversation and ancient Greek history at the Monocle Cafe.
Some of the stories are factual. And some of them are improbable, but all of them are compulsively entertaining. And it's that really that means that Herodotus is not just the first historian, but he's also the first great Shaggy Dog storyteller.
All that, plus music, a trip to the Frankfurt Book Fair, and we'll look ahead to the rest of the day on Monocle 24. That's Aperitivo with me, Andrew Muller, coming up right now. So, bunches coming up in the next 60 minutes here on Aperitivo. But before all that, here's Barney Burnham with the latest news.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. The International Chemical Weapons Watchdog has called on the warring factions in Syria to declare a truce so that its inspectors can meet their deadlines for finding and destroying the country's chemical weapons. Ahmet Uzumtu, head of the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, says the Syrian government has so far been cooperative and constructive, but there's still much work to be done. And he believes cooperation from all parties could make it possible to destroy the chemical arsenal by the middle of next year.
If we can ensure some cooperation by all parties and if some temporary ceasefires, in fact, could be established in order to permit our experts to work in a permissive environment, I think the targets could be reached.
Italy's Prime Minister has announced there'll be a state funeral for hundreds of African migrants who died when their boat capsized close to the island of Lampedusa. At least 274 people died, around 75 more are still missing. Earlier, Enrico Letta was heckled as he visited Lampedusa with the European Commission President José Manuel Barroso. Mr. Barroso said he'd been stunned by the tragedy.
That image of hundreds of coffins will never get out of my mind. It's something I think one cannot forget. Coffins of babies. Coffins with a mother and a child that was born just at that moment. This is something that profoundly shocked me and deeply saddened myself.
The White House says President Obama has agreed to meet Democrats from the House of Representatives later today to discuss the budget crisis and a looming debt deadline. An official said the meeting would be the first of a series of talks with lawmakers of both parties. Other caucuses, including Republicans from both houses of Congress, will be invited in the coming days. A war crimes tribunal in Bangladesh has sentenced a former minister from the main opposition party to life in prison. Abdul Alim is the latest to be convicted over charges linked to the 1971 War of Independence from Pakistan. Last week, another senior opposition figure was sentenced to death for crimes against humanity. And the lawyer for the former military dictator Pervez Musharraf says he could leave Pakistan as soon as Thursday after a decision by a court paving the way for his release. He returned to Pakistan in March after nearly 4 years of self-imposed exile to contest a general election in May, but he was disqualified from standing because of pending court cases. Since then, he's been under house arrest in a villa on the outskirts of Islamabad. Ahmed Raza Kasuri says Musharraf will be free to leave the country and fly anywhere in the world once the legal formalities are completed.
As soon as the direction would come, the jail authority, which are now sitting in the General Musharraf private house, they will pack up and they will go back to Odiala jail, where from they had come. And the status of his house would be converted from that of sub-jail to a private residence of General Pervez Musharraf.
Female members of Saudi Arabia's influential Shura Council, which advises King Abdullah, have proposed allowing women to drive, challenging a tradition upheld by the deeply conservative clerical establishment. Hanan al-Ahmadi, one of 30 women appointed by the king to the council in January, said the issue of letting women drive came up on Tuesday, apparently spontaneously, during discussions about the transport ministry's performance. Conservative Saudis say letting women drive would encourage the sexes to mix in public unchaperoned and thus threaten public morality. Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Barney. You're listening to Aperitivo here on Monocle 24. We'll be back right after this.
Vanuit London. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London. 这是 Monocle 24.
Outlondo, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London. London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
And you are listening to the Aperitivo. The time here in London is 18.06, which makes it 13.06 in New York. Joining me now in the studio with their take on the news is Jeffrey Kaufman, the London correspondent for ABC News. That's the American variety, not the Australian. And Matthew Jamieson, consultant fellow at London-based defence think tank, the Royal United Services Institute. Gentlemen, welcome both to the programme.
So this is called Aperitivo. I'm just looking, where is the bar?
That's a fair question. We should have a cocktail cabinet in here, shouldn't we?
I'd like at least to have the conceit of one for the listeners so they can imagine us tinkling. Could we have some sound effects, please, of martini glasses?
Yeah, if you could all imagine that we are sipping from martini glasses with, you know, those little paper umbrellas in them. Yeah, something like that. Imagine that's a paper umbrella. Anyway, we will start today with the recent comments of Sir Andrew Parker, the Director General of Britain's Domestic Security Agency, MI5. In his first public speech since taking command of MI5 in April, Sir Andrew made a robust defence of the state's need and right to keep secrets in the process delivering a severe wigging to media outlets which have recently taken a different view. Sir Andrew appeared upset on two levels. One, that revelations of the internal workings of the security services might hamper their pursuit of genuine threats. Two, that leaks such as this encourage the notion that Western security services are rummaging in our email inboxes and social media accounts when they should be catching terrorists rather than watching our carefully curated collections of videos of cats riding on self-propelled vacuum cleaners while dressed as sharks. A personal favourite, that one, but you get the idea. Matthew, he delivered this speech at RUSI. Were you there?
Yes, I had the privilege of being there, yes. It was a very interesting evening.
And did he say anything especially surprising?
Not to my mind, really. I felt as though a lot of it, we've already heard before. I think that the most important thing, really, is that we mustn't get too carried away with the whole Edward Snowden and WikiLeaks business. It is important, at the end of the day, to keep secrets secret. And we have a fine line between, on the one hand, preserving, you know, issues of privacy and civil liberties and so on. But we live in a very, very dangerous world. And there are a lot of terrible people who are plotting all sorts of things, and we need to ensure that we have the capability to stop that. And in fact, by publishing a lot of this classified material, we are actually, in many ways, advertising the intelligence gathering techniques which help prevent massive terrorist atrocities.
You talk there about keeping secrets. How realistic an ambition is that in today's world?
Well, I think it has to be an objective of any government, really. I mean, it is realistic because at the end of the day, there are certain things that are not meant for public consumption. We have to take all the steps necessary to preserve that, or else we would live in complete anarchy, actually.
Jeffrey Kaufman, from a journalist's point of view.
You know, traditionally that view has been trust us. We know what's in your interest, a kind of paternalistic view of diplomats and civil servants. And I think what WikiLeaks and the Snowden affair have exposed is that, first of all, an awful lot of what's confidential just doesn't need to be. Of course, we need to have some secrets. Governments need to do things behind the scenes, and not everything can be transparent. But I think what's being exposed here is the ridiculous extent to which secrecy is used to cover the most banal. And while much of while WikiLeaks and Snowden both exposed some serious issues, I think what the other part of the story is just how much of what we saw there was just not important enough to be secret. And so, you know, I think what we're seeing is an accountability, and these guys just don't like it. They don't like to have to answer for their secrecy, and for so many generations they have never had to. But what we're in a new age, and there are going to be more Snowdens, there are going to be more Julian Assanges, and so I think that they would be well advised to be much more selective in what they keep secret, and then keep it secret by not giving it giving access to so many people. Of course, I should add that part of what happened was that after 9/11, it was found that different bodies weren't talking to one another, yeah. And that's why they've opened it up, and the Bradley Mannings of the world could actually get it.
So yeah. Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, part of the problem, of course, before 9/11 was that there wasn't enough joined-up communication in the intelligence-gathering agencies in America. And so they worked to rectify that. And then, of course, unfortunately, it has actually made it more susceptible to these types of leaks. But I feel as though, you know, governments have to have the ability to be able to communicate in private with one another, just as individuals want to be able to communicate in private with one another. And governments have to be able to conduct diplomacy and international relations without feeling as though everybody is always constantly listening and watching, because there are some issues that are so sensitive that they require a certain amount of discretion. And I don't see really how it can help, I mean, someone like Julian Assange just dumping highly classified diplomatic cables into the world without any proper contextualization.
The point about the Assange dump, though, the WikiLeaks dump, is they weren't that secret. The stuff that was dumped was stuff that millions of people with quite low clearance had read. I do remember speaking to a former British ambassador around that time and asking him, would leaks like this make his job any more difficult? And he was an ambassador who had worked in some extremely sensitive postings. And he described it as a nuisance. And he said, but really, there was nothing in those that either you didn't know or couldn't have guessed.
Yes.
And it doesn't really matter whether it should or shouldn't. That's not really the argument. It's going to. And so these guys who run the spy agencies in the UK and Europe and North America have got to figure out a new approach to secrets. And they can't, as I say, I think they've got to find a way to keep less more secure rather than this kind of broad sweep. And I think that they, you know, we're going to talk shortly about newspapers adjusting to the new reality. This is a paradigm shift in every way, communications, and that's what we're going through.
Do you think that's maybe just it, that he's basically trying to defend 19th century spycraft
age of 21st century technology? But I would certainly say 1950s Cold War spycraft, yeah.
I mean, this was something I remember speaking to a former MI6 agent some years ago who made the way he described the new world was, he just said, if you take some just banal factoid like the top speed of a Russian-built armored personnel carrier, which he said 30 years ago would have taken weeks, months of patient fieldcraft to discern. And of course, he said, now anybody with a laptop can find out the same thing in seconds.
Yeah, I mean, the environment has completely changed technologically. And I agree, actually, with Jeff's point. And that was echoed last night at the meeting, actually. There were some people that brought this up, that actually the intelligence service could afford to show a little bit more leg in terms of what they are, you know, up to.
Well, I mean, but they do. I mean, the British government only admitted that MI6 actually existed in 1994.
Indeed, yeah. this is a new tradition of actually even knowing so much about the Director General. I mean, in the olden days, you wouldn't have heard anything about his name or her name or their background, and they certainly never gave lectures on public record. So I think that, you know, they are moving forward, and there is probably room to move further forward in terms of being a little bit more open. But I still think that we need to, you know, we have intelligence services for a very important role. And, you know, we don't live in a particularly nice world, and there are a lot of terrible things going on, and we have to be able to defend ourselves. And we have to, you know, make sure that we are able to get as much information on what's going on. There's so many plots, you know. I mean, there's about 330 people over the last decade. 330 people have been convicted in this country alone of plotting terrorist outrages. And that's the ones that have been brought to justice.
He was also, I mean, the words he used himself, he made an effort at reassurance. He said, you know, we're not living in East Germany or North Korea. He was keen to disabuse this idea that your GCHQ has thousands of people leafing through our inboxes for their own amusement or intelligence gathering or cats riding on self-propelled vacuum cleaners as, as they see fit. But is it just arguable that the nature of modern communication and modern technology means that they can barely avoid finding out more about us than the Stasi could about citizens of the GDR?
Well, that's the problem. I mean, because at the end of the day, you know, the whole thing with PRISM was that it wasn't actually the case that they were looking through, American citizens or British citizens' emails and phone records and so on. It was the fact that they had the capability to do so and that they may be able to, through this back door, go through all sorts of information. It's a difficult balancing act, but, you know, we really do, I think, it's frustrating with someone like Edward Snowden because, quite frankly, one has to question what was Edward Snowden's motives in doing this. Was he just an individual acting alone? Was he actually being manipulated by other foreign intelligence agencies? Why did he go to China? Well, Hong Kong, China. And then why did he go to Russia? If he was so concerned about civil liberties and freedom of speech and freedom of expression, it's pretty peculiar place to go to, like Russia, which is one of the most authoritarian countries at the moment with a terrible human rights record. I mean, and a terrible record when it comes to journalists. They just kill journalists that they don't agree with. But he didn't seem to have any problem going to Moscow. And it was interesting to see whether or not he's actually been in contact with the FSB and whether he's debriefed other foreign intelligence agencies about the things that he's been doing. So we have to, I think, be very skeptical about the Snowdens of this world.
Jeffrey, what responsibility does a media outlet have when presented with something like a Snowden? Where on your list of things to consider is the potential security of the state?
I think when you read about the way The Guardian and The New York Times handled this, I think that they did exactly what you have to do. You can't just do a document dump. You've got to go through. And first of all, when you have that much documentation, there's too much to publish all at once, and it would be crazy. But more importantly, you want to make sure that, as they did, they redacted names of people and details that they felt were of serious national security threat. And so, you know, they acted responsibly, and there's no evidence that what they published has actually compromised anyone. On the Snowden question, I take it face value. You know, I'm not inherently a conspiracy theorist. I'm a skeptic as a journalist, but I think he's a young guy who didn't like the intelligence gathering apparatus and who decided that through a kind of Joan of Arc zeal that he was going to expose it. I'm not sure he thought about what would happen afterwards. And I think the reason he ended up in Hong Kong and Russia is because he didn't really have very many other places to go and he got squeezed. I'm very interested to know whether the FSB, the state intelligence apparatus in Russia, has been in touch with them. I can't imagine they haven't, but they claim they haven't. And so...
Well, you would have to say, if they haven't, what are they doing?
Well, you kind of feel that way. Now, he obviously doesn't have those hard drives with him. It's pretty clear, and they exist in a number of countries. One of the things that has very shrewdly been done is, when the British authorities tried to take them from The Guardian, which they actually made The Guardian destroy their computers, they made it very clear that other copies of this data existed in other countries. And I think Iceland has the freest, is that right? Yeah. Has the freest freedom of information laws, or the most liberal. And I think there are copies there, and in the U.S. and other places. So you can't erase it. You know, it's like it's like a scandalous photo on the internet. It's you just can't get rid of it.
I mean, it is the metaphor that always leaps to my mind. Things like this, it's like stamping on mercury. Once the you just tend to distribute it over a wider area. But speaking as a skeptical journalist, to what extent did you hear Sir Andrew's speech as a well, maybe not an attempt to intimidate, but a shot across the bows, if you will.
You know, I just think that these guys have got to rethink their approach, their strategy. I think it comes down to that. I think that they've got to accept that they can't go back to the 1950s. And I don't think they know how to do that yet. And I can understand their sense of concern because there are secrets, but I just don't think they're there yet. I wasn't there, though. Matthew, did you get any sense that they're modernizing their approach?
Yeah, I think that certainly with you've knighted, I think, Andrew. I don't know if you've got a knighthood yet. I'm not sure. I think he's just plain Andrew Parker still.
He'll be delighted to hear Monocle.
But I think, you know, I have great confidence in him because he struck me as somebody who really, not only formidably bright as you would expect, but really a very personable, open approach. And I feel as though they're really going to have to engage, as you say, with thinking through in this new 21st century, very sort of, you know, high-tech, social, media-driven age, how they go about not only collecting their data, but how they present it and how they utilize it. And just the nature of the role of intelligence gathering, I think, needs to be better explained to the public rather than having it is this sort of shadowy James Bond style sort of organization.
It is credited with a knighthood by some media outlets. Not necessarily with others, but I think we can assume if by the end of his tenure we're not all speaking Farsi, he will probably get one.
So
we're only being a little bit premature.
Preemptive knighthood.
A preemptive knighthood. Yes. If at all. I mean, what do you think what positive steps do you think the security services could take in developing a modern relationship with modern media?
Well, I think that the steps, first of all, like the lecture last night, and then if they broaden that out into, you know, public forums, in other parts of the country, if they maybe engaged more with the media, perhaps gave more, you know, press briefings, and, you know, cultivated deeper relationships with journalists as well, and trusted journalists, you know. I feel as though...
Sorry, I have to snicker. Yeah. I've never answered for anyone but myself. When you talk about journalists as a group, it's impossible.
I know, but you're talking about two groups of people who are engaged in very similar lines of work, of like trying to find stuff out, and also are not given necessarily to taking other people's words for anything. It is a very curious relationship between the two groups of people, but we will be talking more shortly about at least one of those groups of people, i.e. journalists. We will take a short break now. I'm here with Jeffrey Kaufman and Matthew Jameson here on Aperitivo, and we will be looking shortly at the future, pray that there is one, of newspapers.
The rugged and romantic Scottish Highlands are not the Glenlivet's only inspiration. Since 1824, this single malt has combined unique flavours to create one of the world's most awarded whiskies. The Guardian's Chapter is their next limited edition whisky, with a taste that will be decided by the Glenlivet's own community of enthusiasts from around the world. To discover more and write the next chapter of the legacy, join the Guardians at theglenlivet.com. The Glenlivet, the single malt that started it all. Enjoy responsibly.
And welcome back to Aperitivo here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me is Jeffrey Kaufman from ABC News and Matthew Jameson from the Royal United Services Institute. In a recent interview, Alan Rusbridger, editor of the previously discussed Guardian, said that he could imagine the paper ceasing to print a physical edition within 5 to 10 years. A terribly depressing prospect for those of us, Monocle very much among them, who believe that no app has yet been programmed which compares to the physical and aesthetic pleasure of reading on paper. This appears, however, however, to be the view of a dwindling and perhaps sentimental minority. Yesterday, staff at the Financial Times received a memo informing them that the venerable pink publication will launch a single global edition print paper in the first half of next year. The memo from editor Lionel Barber was upfront about the wider significance of this. In future, he said, our print product will derive from the web offering, not vice versa. Now, is the FT just getting ahead of the field in resigning itself to the inevitable? So I welcome back our studio guests, Geoffrey Kaufman, the London correspondent for ABC News, and Matthew Jameson, consultant fellow at defence think tank Royal United Services Institute. I'll come to you, Geoffrey, first as the journalist. Are you at all surprised that the FT is doing this?
I am surprised. I'm actually having some fun this fall and teaching a university course on critical thinking and journalism for non-journalists. And so we've been talking about this, and I've had a number of interesting guests. And we have talked about what I loosely call the crisis in journalism, which really means that the old line television, newspaper, commercial model is under is struggling for survival. And what surprises me about the FT is that we all know that the two most lucrative franchises in journalism are business and sports.
Yeah.
And when you see the Wall Street Journal and the FT being the bastions of business journalism, and when you see the FT saying we have to trim back our old line legacy products and move more towards digital, that really is alarming, because what it says is that what the metropolitan dailies in the UK and in North America and around the world are experiencing is even hitting the most stable, the most secure, the most lucrative. And so that's why I find it really, really interesting and quite shocking. I had, as a guest in my class by Skype, the editor of one of the biggest papers in North America. He said that they are losing 12% of their advertising revenue every year, which means in 3 years, if you multiply it, they're losing half. They will have lost half of their revenue. And he said at this point, 91% of their income still comes from the print edition. So digital with a paywall is simply not bringing in the kind of money. He's closed all of his foreign bureau, put money into travel. But he said it's just we're trying to figure out. The metaphor he used was this. He said, as a newspaper editor anywhere in the English speaking world, the metaphor is this: the barn is on fire and the horses are still inside and the door is locked. And he said that's what it's like going to work. And the FT is clearly acknowledging that.
Matthew Jameson, on that cheerful image, you work for a think tank, which of course does lots of research of current events. Is the problem basically that a newspaper, by which I mean a paper newspaper, can now, by definition, really only tell you what you found out yesterday?
That is a real problem, actually, because, now we live in this, constant 24-7 news cycle, and it's just never-ending. And it's not like, the old days in the 70s or 80s, where everything seemed to shut down at about, 10 o'clock and so on, and everybody went to sleep, and then you never heard anything until the next day. That is a great problem. But I'm just so dismayed because, the Financial Times, I think, is the best quality newspaper in this country. It's the only really good top quality newspaper left in this country. All the other top broadsheets have just gone to pot, and the quality has completely collapsed, apart from The Guardian. But the rest of them, like The Times, The Telegraph, everything, that's absolute rubbish.
I disagree slightly, and not just because I'm occasionally employed by a couple of those titles.
But we don't have a New York Times in
this
country.
He didn't trash the Daily Mail.
No. That's not a top quality. But the idea, to not no longer have a sort of a, to be able to touch a newspaper and feel it and read it, and have everything digital, I just think aesthetically it's so sad. I will never own a Kindle because
no, I agree with you entirely. Is it just a generational
You're a Luddite. You're a Luddite.
Is it just a generational thing? I read on screens a lot, but only when I need to find stuff out. I would never read anything on a screen for pleasure.
I must say The Guardian. Guardian's web iPad app is utterly brilliant. It is so much better than any other newspaper, including the New York Times. It is absolutely they've got it.
But they're losing the thick end of a million quid a week.
Well, but they are actually their losses are diminishing. I mean, they're owned by the Scott Trust. The Scott Trust has about £250 million in its piggy bank, and they feel that as long as they can minimize their losses, they've got a long life ahead, and that's what they're trying to do. And you talked about Alan Rutsberger, the very very innovative editor of The Guardian. And his strategy is to completely refashion what was the Manchester Guardian, became the Guardian in the 60s when it moved to London. And now it's going to be really the World Guardian. He's opened a very, very big newsroom in New York. He's just opened in Australia. And because of these big, he's put huge resources into investigative journalism when many, many news organizations are putting resources into covering the royal family and the latest YouTube video. And he's getting a huge audience. In fact, in the summer, they had more viewers online, The Guardian, in the U.S. than they did in the U.K. Mm-hmm. And now they're working to figure out how to monetize it. And that, of course, is the $50 million question.
It is indeed. Mm-hmm. And on that $50 million question, gentlemen, we will have to leave it there. Thank you both, Geoffrey Kaufman, London correspondent for ABC News, and Matthew Jameson, consultant fellow at RUSI. Thank you both very much for joining us here on Aperitivo.
Vanuit London. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London. This is Monocle 24.
Orlando, tu é Monocle 24.
Para London, dette é Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Holanda.
London. London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monocle 24.
And there's loads still to come in the second half of today's Aperitivo. We'll be heading up the street to the Monocle Cafe to talk classic Greek history, and we'll preview what's coming up on today's Globalist Asia and Monocle Daily. But before we get started on all that, here's Barney Burnham with the world news headlines.
Thanks, Andrew. The International Chemical Weapons Watchdog has called on the warring factions in Syria to declare a truce so its inspectors can meet their deadlines for finding and destroying the country's chemical weapons. The head of the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons says the Syrian government has so far been cooperative, but there's still much work to be done. Italy's prime minister has announced there'll be a state funeral for hundreds of African migrants who died when their boat capsized close to the island of Lampedusa. Excuse me, at least 274 people died and around 75 more are still missing. The White House says President Obama has agreed to meet Democrats from the House of Representatives later today to discuss the budget crisis and a looming debt deadline. An official said the meeting will be the first of a series of talks with lawmakers of both parties. A war crimes tribunal in Bangladesh has sentenced a former minister from the main opposition party to life in prison. Abdul Alim is the latest to be convicted over charges linked to the 1971 War of Independence from Pakistan. And the lawyer for Pakistan's former military dictator, Pervez Musharraf, says he could leave the country as soon as Thursday after a decision by a court paved the way for his release. He's been under house arrest in a villa on the outskirts of Islamabad since May, where he returned to Pakistan in March after nearly 4 years of self-imposed exile to contest the general election, but was disqualified from standing because of pending court cases. And female members of Saudi Arabia's influential Shura Council, which advises King Abdullah, have proposed allowing women to drive. Conservative Saudis say letting women drive would encourage the sexes to mix in public unchaperoned and thus threaten public morality. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, Barney. It's 2013 and they're arguing about letting women drive or not.
Well, you know, 100 years on from when we were arguing about when they could vote, I think that the greater risk is not to public morality. It's the risk of unleashing thousands of new petrol heads.
It is, in fairness, and this is not to make any jokes whatsoever about female drivers at all. It's just the idea, if you have any experience of Middle Eastern roads, I do take your point that the idea of unleashing millions more drivers of either gender upon them is a somewhat terrifying prospect, especially in Saudi Arabia, where you do, of course, have that combination of lots of expensive, really fast cars and beautiful, new, expensive roads.
it's not a place I yearn to visit, and whether or not women drive will not influence my decision in any way at all.
No, no, it will not be for the faint-hearted, Saudi Arabian motoring. Barney, thank you. Welcome back to Aperitivo, live here on Monocle 24. The time is 21:33 in Moscow, 18:33 here in London, 14:33 in Rio de Janeiro. It's time now to head to the Monocle Cafe on nearby Chilton Street, and on today's show we meet Tom Holland, whose new translation of the histories by Herodotus is out now. The 5th century Greek historian is plausibly the first ever author of non-fiction. His magnum opus, The Histories, is a chronicle of the invasion of Greece by the armies of Persia, which is to say a clash between the mutually uncomprehending West and East. It is arguable that it's when you put the possessive on the end of it that you really lose it. Anyway, it's arguable that his The Histories is the one we have been repeating ever since. Our producer Daniel caught up with Tom a bit earlier in the cafe over a hot Americano.
The core event that lies at the heart of Herodotus' history is, I think, not just the most thrilling episode in ancient history, but in history full stop. It's basically, as the Greeks understand it, Lord of the Rings only true. And what you have is the sort of great empire in the east, the Persian Empire, which at the time, in the beginning of the 5th century BC, is the undisputed superpower, the global superpower, enormous, vast empire stretching from the Aegean to the Hindu Kush. And they go to invade Greece, which I guess in ancient terms is sort of the equivalent of Afghanistan. It's a mountainous, remote backwater full of squabbling people who are always fighting each other. And by every consideration, the Persians should have won. Their army is huge, their fleet is huge. By some estimations, it's the largest amphibious invasion of Europe until D-Day. And yet, amazingly, against all the odds, the Greeks hold out, led by the Athenians and by the Spartans. And so that's it's a thrilling story. But over on top of that, even though that is what Herodotus says in his opening sentence, that he wants to explain how it was that the Greeks and the Persians came to war and what happened, he also gives us vastly more than that, because what I think he realizes is that in the Greek and the Persian wars, the whole world is at stake. The Persians are, it's a global empire, and so therefore he needs to make sense of the whole world. And so what you get for about half his histories, before he gets to the famous battles, is an extraordinary panoramic account of the entire 5th century world, from the cat-owning habits of the Egyptians to the way that the Scythians took cannabis, to how the Indians get their gold from giant ants. And some of the stories are factual, and some of them are improbable, but all of them are compulsively entertaining. And it's that really that means that Herodotus is not just the first historian, but he's also the first great shaggy dog storyteller. And I cannot emphasize how much fun he is.
How was your relationship with Herodotus? I mean, as his translator, you must have picked up a lot of his quirks, his habits, his turns of phrase. I mean, how did you kind of come to learn him as you were translating his words?
My association with Herodotus actually long precedes that, because I was the kind of geeky boy who was very into Greek warfare when I was about 12. And so I realized that I was going to have to read Herodotus, and I went to the library and got it off the shelves. It's rather intimidating. I mean, it was the first ever classic that I'd read. And I was bemused to begin with that I wasn't getting the stuff that I thought I was going to get, that the Battle of Thermopylae was not appearing in the pages. But he's one of those writers who accompanies you over the course of your life. Every time I read him, I find fresh things. And so the chance to translate him, to live in a sort of degree of intimacy with him, as it were, every day, was a wonderful one. And I guess you asked me, what did I think about him? Well, it's a bit like a marriage, that it's sink or swim. I mean, you're really putting yourself to the test. All I can say is that when I finished it, on one level, I was deeply satisfied and sort of relieved. And on the other hand, I felt a sort of sense of bereavement. I wouldn't be living with him in the way that I had been. And that reflects the fact that he is such a wonderfully entertaining, warm, and almost lovable companion. And the experience of spending 5 years translating him didn't damage my feeling of that. It only confirmed it.
What do we actually know about him as a man? He seems to be a bit of a mystery.
We don't know a huge amount. He's born in the 5th century BC. He starts writing a few decades after the great events of the Persian War, in about probably 440 BC. And he grows up in the, not in Greece proper, but in the town called Halicarnassus, which is now Bodrum. It's a sort of yachting city. So the interesting thing about Herodotus is that although he is a Greek, he grows up a subject of the Persian king. And so that may well explain the sort of curiously tolerant perspective that he brings to both the Persians and the Greeks. He's interested in all of them. And we know that ultimately he ends up in Italy, in a settlement in Italy. But based on the evidence of the histories, he was probably a merchant, probably something to do with Mediterranean shipping. He seems familiar with the Mediterranean, and he must have traveled. He must have gone to Egypt. I think he went to Babylon, although there are many who would dispute that. But beyond that, we can't really say. Everything that we know derives from the histories.
So your translation, why now? What drove you to do this translation?
Well, it was simply because Penguin gave me the chance to do it. They said, would I do it? And I leapt at the chance. Because, as I said, I always loved Herodotus, and the opportunity to have this degree of close reading of him was one that I absolutely, completely welcomed. The other factor is that it's the best way to, to keep an ancient language, which you're not going to hear speaking, you're not going to practice speaking it yourself. It's the best way to keep it going. So it's kind of like, an intellectual keep fit regime, one that you absolutely have to keep to.
And as compared to the existing translations, what does yours add? Did you take a different approach?
Well, every translation is about getting the balance between adherence to the original text and hopefully vibrant and flowing English. And so that's why there's always room for a fresh translation, because you need one for each new generation, really, particularly when you're dealing with a text as classic and significant as Herodotus. So I hope that people will feel that it feels contemporary and yet simultaneously strange, because if it just read like the equivalent of an opinion piece in a newspaper, then I would have failed. There has to be a slight timbre of strangeness about it to the text. Equally, I don't want people to feel that it's completely alienating. So I hope that I've successfully negotiated that particular tightrope.
And finally, do you think there's any kind of lesson that modern world leaders, your Putins, your Assads, your Obamas, might learn from a book like this?
Well, the lesson that Herodotus draws from it is that you should not become overweening. You should not be what he calls hubristic. You should not aspire to a state that is higher than a man should aspire to. This idea of cycles of empire, that you reach a certain pinnacle and then you are doomed to fall. So that's obviously an idea that is quite hardwired, I think, into our minds. And it's obviously one, I think, that haunts probably any political leader. There is also, however, I think, a more hopeful lesson, which is one very well attuned to the vastly more multicultural world that we live in now relative to, say, the last Penguin Classics translation. This came out in the 50s. And that is that Herodotus has what seems to me a wonderfully enlightened approach to the issue of cultural difference. And it's summed up in a story where Darius, the Persian king, summons Greeks and Indians, so people from the opposite ends of his empire. And he says to the Greeks, what would it take to persuade you to eat your parents when they're dead? And the Greeks, who burn their parents when they're dead, throw their hands up in horror and say, absolutely nothing. Then he turns to the Indians, whose habit it is to eat their parents when they're dead, and says, what would it take you to burn your parents? And likewise, they throw their hands up in horror. And Herodotus says, this, it seems to me, proves that Pindar, the great poet, was right when he said that custom is king. But the wonderful sort of refinement of that is that the fulcrum of that story, the man who is central to it, is a Persian king. So in a story that is about how the Greeks defeated the Persians, it's a Persian king who takes center stage in Herodotus's account and exploration of how relative custom is. And that seems to me wonderfully wise and enlightened, and definitely the kind of perspective that has a relevance for us now.
That was Tom Holland, whose new translation of the histories by Herodotus is out now, speaking to our producer Daniel Giacopelli. Up next, we'll be looking ahead to this year's Frankfurt Book Fair. Stay tuned to find out more on this episode of Aperitivo on Monocle 24.
Inspiring the likes of Charles Dickens since 1824, the Glenlivet may be the definitive Speyside single malt whiskey, but that's just one chapter of the story. Master distiller Alan Winchester is inviting the Glenlivet's global community of whisky connoisseurs to help curate the flavors of their next limited edition whisky, The Guardian's Chapter. To discover more, join the Guardians at theglenlivet.com. The Glenlivet, the single malt that started it all. Enjoy responsibly.
Do you ever survey a parade of shops and gathered locals and wonder why the scene is so inviting? Well, to find out, Monocle's editor-in-chief Tyler Brulé ventured to Wilton Way, a small thoroughfare in East London's Hackney, to get a read on the ingredients that underpin a community.
In a former post office at number 67, Borough Wines is a perfect example of modern renewal born out of village ideals. The success of Muriel Châtel's Hackney Wine Shop is down to the daily engagement with the locals. In addition to the expertly chosen bottles on the shelves, Borough Wines provides a fill your bottle at the barrel service, offering simply one red, one white, and one rosé at a comforting price.
You can watch Tyler Brulé's Hackney Revival film in the programmes menu on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Aperitivo with me, Andrew Muller. For a few days in mid-October each year, there is simply no point in trying to call anyone involved in book publishing. The Frankfurt Book Fair draws in nearly 300,000 visitors from all over the world, and this year they'll be able to look in on 7,300 exhibitors from more than 100 countries. It may not, however, be a riotous celebration. Even the most determined optimist would concede that times are on the trying side of challenging, as the old models of paper-bound publishing come under ever greater pressure from various electronic insurgents. Well, joining us now to look forward to the fair is Charmaine Lovegrove, founder and director of publishing for Dialogue Berlin. Charmaine, first of all, draw us a picture, if you will, of the scale of the Frankfurt Book Fair. How big a thing is it?
Well, if your listeners are familiar with Earls Court in London, then, you know, that's probably two football pitches. I would say that Frankfurt is probably 15 to 20 football pitches in size and draws 500,000 to 700,000 people from all over the world.
And what are you personally going to be looking for this year?
I'm there in the capacity, I'm here in the capacity as a book scout working for film, television rights for international production companies based in Hollywood and the UK and Germany. And on the other side, I'm looking as an agent for my authors to be represented in the UK and international markets.
And what kind of, what kind of mood do you expect the market to be in? Are people buying much? And if so, what are they buying?
There's it's the first day of the book fair, so there's a lot of talk. There has been some buying, and there's a lot of excitement. What I'm expecting to see over the course of this book fair is a surge in international rights from the UK and US. Predominantly, they both buy around 5% of international titles for translation, and I expect to see a surge in that. So the Scandinavian, the German, the Eastern European markets are expected to see doing much better this year.
I mean, are there any, you know, it's that thing that we were talking about, a variation of this earlier in the show as it applies to newspapers, but the overwhelming of the physical product by the digital equivalent. Does anybody in publishing appear to be having any brilliant, successful ideas about how to cope with that transition?
I think that actually that whole digital versus traditional has really calmed down. I did a stint at a digital publishing company, and in the end, it seems to, so I have an awareness of both digital and traditional. And in the end, it really seems that the story is at the core, and that we don't want to call it content anymore, and we don't want to get excited about digital, because in the end, digital is simply a format in the same way that paper is a format. And they seem to kind of run as sort of parallel industries this year more than they ever have before. And I think that what's really interesting about that is, you know, how that's going to play out to the consumers, because I think the readers are still seeing a battle. But in the end, digital is really just a format. It's an EPUB file as opposed to the printed book. So it's really up to the readers as to which one they want to use. And so that argument seems to have kind of really settled down this year, I've seen.
All that said, Germany itself is one place where bookstores and physical books are actually holding up relatively well. Why do you think that is?
Germany has something that's called the Buchpreisverbindung, which is where they have the net book agreement. In Britain and the US, that was abolished 13 years ago. And so the price of the book, the RRP price, the recommended retail price that you would see on the back of the book, is something that booksellers and Amazon and supermarkets can ignore in the UK. Whereas in Germany, they can't ignore that. The other thing is that in Germany, booksellers are trained. They do a degree. It's just a really different industry how the society, the readers, value the price of the book and value the stories. So for me, that's the two biggest differences between the UK and the German market.
Charmaine, thanks for that. That was Charmaine Lovegrove, founder and director of publishing for Dialogue Berlin. And it's time now for a bit of music here on Aperitivo, and moving seamlessly along from our previous item, this is Elvis Costello and the Attractions from his weird mid-80s Philly soul phase. It is inevitably Every Day I Write the Book. Elvis Costello and the Attractions with Every Day I Write the Book. You're listening to Aperitivo here on Monocle 24. We are approaching the end of the programme, but before we get there, we'll have a look at what's coming up on tonight's programmes later on Monocle 24. I'm joined now by the producers of The Globalist Asia and Barb. The Globalist Asia, what I was going to do is the whole respectively thing. I'm joined respectively by the producers of Globalist Asia and The Daily, Marcus Hippie and Barbara Feeney.
Welcome. Andrew, I know it's hard. Thank you for inviting us here.
It's complicated reading out this stuff that's written down into a microphone. It involves reading and speaking at the same time.
And trying to think on the side.
I know, it's not as easy as, in fairness, most of the time I make it look. Marcus, what is on the Globalist Asia?
Well, Globalist Asia starts in about 1 hour and, well, quite precisely 1 hour and 6 minutes. And we are going to start the programme by looking at what's been going on at ASEAN Summit in Brunei. Obviously, big countries, they're hoping to achieve something, and now that US President Barack Obama, for obvious reasons, can't attend over there, we're asking if this is quite a unique opportunity for China to actually achieve more than that country otherwise would have achieved.
Because all of a sudden, Xi Jinping becomes the center of gravity.
Exactly. Do you wish you were him in this kind of a moment?
That's all the attention. That's a question I've never been asked. Do I wish I was the paramount leader of the Communist Party of China? It would have its perks.
I'd like to try for a week.
What would you in the admittedly unlikely event, Marcus, that you were ever put in charge of China for a week, what would you do?
Never say never. That's a tricky one. I need to think about that. I would stop all the wars.
Wow. That'd be fun.
But we're talking about other stories on the Globalist Asia. We're also shifting our gaze to Pakistan, looking at what's going on over there when it comes to Pakistani government trying to deal with the Taliban somehow. This is also, this week marks the anniversary of the event when this young girl going to school, Malala, got shot in the head. We are looking at if anything's changed during the last 12 months or so. At the same time, there is an interesting new opening by Pakistani Taliban leader Hakimullah Mehsud, who's told in an interview that he is actually open to serious talks with the government of Pakistan, but he says that at the same time he has not yet been approached. We also speak to our Buenos Aires correspondent Ed Stocker to hear the latest discussion topics and gossip from his sitting.
And that presumably will be focused quite a lot on the health travails of President Kirchner. Barbara, moving along to you, who's producing tonight's Daily, and this is quite exciting for me because I'm co-presenting tonight's Daily and I have no idea what's on the programme as yet. So enlighten me along with the listeners.
Well, Andrew, so first of all, we are going to talk about the US plan to pull some of the military aid that they provide to Egypt. So we're going to ask, you know, why they're doing this, what effect could it have on Egypt? So that was just kind of announced today via US News Network. So we're going to look further into that. And then we are moving to Brazil. We're going to be talking about Marina Silva, who has just recently joined the Socialist Party. And we're going to ask about her prospects for potentially running for president, because she's really quite a popular candidate and did quite well in the last presidential election.
Okay, the Egypt aid story, this one's been cooking for a while. This is why America hasn't been calling the coup d'etat in Egypt a coup d'etat, because they would then be legally obliged to stop sending the Egyptians money. It sounds a bit like America is distancing themselves slightly and possibly belatedly. That'll be an interesting one to follow
up. It will. And they're only partially suspending the aid, you know, only they're still going to provide aid for kind of counter-terrorism, to kind of support counter-terrorism, and it's interesting.
And what else do we have?
We are going to also be reviewing the Asian newspapers with Ben Murta. And yeah, there's other things in store, but I don't want to spoil anything. We don't want to tell the listeners everything.
But if Marcus, we do have 30 seconds, I want to continue. Let's have a listener rate war, Barbara, shall we, tonight? So, Globalist Asia, an amazing package. We also talk about Nobel Prizes.
Okay.
Yeah, and we hear like stories from the history, people who should have won Nobel Prize, maybe didn't. We also hear what Serbia is trying to do to get fit to be better in shape for the European Union. This involves a 29-year-old management consultant.
That sounds quite interesting. I wish I was able to listen to it, but I cannot listen to The Globalist Asia, produced by Marcus Hippie, because I will be writing the script for The Daily, produced by Barbara Feeney. Thank you very much to both of us. The Globalist Asia starting about an hour from now, The Daily starting about 3 hours from now, if I'm reading this clock right. Yes, I am. And that is all we have time for on today's Aperitivo. My thanks in particular to our special guests, Jeffrey Kaufman, the London correspondent for ABC, and Matthew Jameson from RUSI. Today's show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Alexa Furmanish and Maddie Arauch, and our studio manager was Bill Lutie. Next up is the latest edition of The Entrepreneurs, where we're at London's Best of Britannia showcase to meet the cream of the crop of British manufacturers.
The thing I love is coming and seeing, you know, young, bright, innovative people who are also often taking a risk. You know, I've talked to people today who said, you know, they've mortgaged their homes on getting their businesses off the ground because they're so desperate to get their brand working.
But for now, from Midori House, this has been Aperitivo. I've been Andrew Muller. Thanks very much for listening.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives: that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.